Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? What?
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
At the Movies on BFM 89.9.
I'm Uma Falcon, I'm Fakir Falcon, and joining me today on this incredibly festive episode of At the Movies are my merry partners in crime, Bahir Yusuf and Ian McNally. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello,
Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
So it's that time of year when everyone does their Christmas recommendations of movies to watch during this holly jolly time, and we usually end up with a very similar sounding list. The more traditionalists go for It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th Street, Die Hard,
Gremlins.
The modernists like themselves a bit of Bad Santa and Elf.
Batman Returns. I did that list last year.
But, you know, like I said, you know those movies and you've heard these lists 100 times. And so today, for your listening pleasure, we're going to talk to you about a Black Christmas, a Shane Black Christmas, that is. But before we get into it, folks, what makes for a good Christmas film? Does it have to have a jolly, wonderful look at this is the spirit of Christmas feel at the end of it?
I'm going to go with Shane Black's own words here. One of the things he says about Christmas in an EW article quite a while back was that Christmas represents a little stutter in the march of days, a hush in which we have a chance to assess and retrospect our lives. It also informs as a backdrop. He goes on to talk about like little bits of magic you see, like a broken Christmas light of Mary hanging off a taco truck in LA, and it's these little moments of magic you see at Christmas. And I think that's Christmas's opportunity. It's the end of the year. It's getting close to a new year. It's people coming together. And you can tie those, people come together or people going away, as you have in Home Alone. It's all those kind of tying together things.
And also for me, I think what's nice about Christmas is that it requires a lot less character setup. Take Die Hard, for example, right? It's a Christmas film. It's become everyone's staple go-to film for the season.
Yep.
And you already know what John McClane wants to do because it's the season of forgiveness and all of that stuff. He's going back to see his estranged wife.
Yeah.
There's very little character setup required because all you need is a conversation with him in a limo with the driver. And given the season and the festivities and the lights, done.
Yeah.
Right?
Riggs is alone at Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. And another great, actually, we'll get to that when we talk about Lethal Weapon, as to why Christmas actually brought those two characters together. It was a great moment in the film.
Yep.
Bahir, is there anything in your head that makes for a good Christmas film? What are the kind of movies that you watch every year? Like, I watch It's a Wonderful Life every year just because it's become part of my staple viewing.
Really?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I love that film. I love Jimmy Stewart, though.
Yeah.
I think for me, because every year my family gets together for a Christmas lunch. We say it's lunch, but it starts about 11, ends about
7 p.m.
Well, I was going to say 2, but okay. So there tends to be a lot of films that we put on TV. So for us, a Christmas film, it's nice if there's snow, if there's all that other stuff. But at the same time, it's kind of a film that you all just sit together and watch as a family.
So Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars is great. I don't know if they'll let me put on Star Wars this year.
Again.
Yeah. But generally, you know, like Die Hard's a great one because the guys in the house can watch it and we all be like, yeah, murder, blood, death, rah, right? But then there's also that whole thing about you know, redemption, about asking for forgiveness. So it does feel Christmassy.
Also, now I have a machine gun, ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah. So I think for me, it's the idea of something you can watch with friends and family and loved ones, preferably with some snow.
Yeah. A little bit of snow.
A little bit of snow, some Christmas lights would be nice.
So, like,
which
it.
Is why I think the Shane Black films are nice because they don't lean on Christmas. This just happens to be a setting. So you've got, like you said, there's a little bit of Christmas lights here and there. You hear the music in the background, but the cast are not
not harping on about
it. Yeah, it's not a Christmas thing. It just so happens to happen around Christmas.
And there are so many of his movies are set in L.A., so it actually feels like it's more like Malaysian Christmas. It's warm out, you know.
It's warm out, and the malls are really well decorated.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's funny you bring up Die Hard being a staple film, because that really ties back into Shane Black, because Joel Silver, who was a producer on Lethal Weapon, liked that Christmas setting so much that he transposed it onto Die Hard, which came out about a year later, I think. And there you go. You had Bruce Willis, Christmas, Machine Guns instead of Sinatra, Christmas and Machine Guns, because he was originally supposed to play John McClane.
Oh, yes, in the older version.
Yeah, the original version. Yeah. That would have been great. I would have loved to see
a Sinatra Die Hard.
I could just imagine him crawling through the vents in like a snappy suit.
Yeah, because he doesn't wear anything else, does he? Yeah. Right?
Yeah. When he's walking over broken glass, singing "I've Got You Under My Skin."
Yes.
Oh!
Made you leave without me.
Hey, what are you doing?
Oh no!
What are you doing?
See this key? Bye bye.
You're crazy.
Now you can jump if you want to, but you'll be taking me with you, and that makes you a murderer. Okay? Come on, let's go
you
back. Yeah, you'd be killing a cop. Now,
yeah, I'd be killing a psycho nut cop.
Yeah, a psycho, but I'm still a cop. You coming in? Come on, I'm going in.
F*** you, I'm jumping.
Do you really want to jump? Do you want to? Well, then that's fine with me. Come on, let's do it.
Wait a minute.
I want to do it. I want to do it.
What do you mean?
But anyway, so we're here to talk about Shane Black. Now, the reason we're talking about Shane Black, of course, is one, well, we all like his movies, but also of the 9 feature films that Shane Black has written, 7 of them-ish take place during Christmas time. And I'm including the film within the film in Last Action Hero, where I think the opening line is, "This is one hell of a way to spend Christmas." And you're right. They're mere settings for these films. They're background. They're props. But at the same time, whenever someone uses Christmas in this film or says Merry Christmas in his films, in Shane Black's movies, in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Val Kilmer's character goes, "Merry Christmas, man. Sorry, you over, right?"
Yeah.
I'll bleep that out.
Yeah.
I was like, "Whoa, we're doing that now." Season 2 rocks.
Is this radio show now a Shane Black movie?
Shane Black does vulgarity like no one else.
Yeah. Looking at the last Boy Scout, I keep on saying Last Action Hero. The Last Boy Scout, like, I'm sure before South Park came along, it was one of the up there with like the highest number of cuss words in a movie. It's just perforated with them.
Yeah. If you don't know Shane Black, I mean, he burst onto the scene with Lethal Weapon. He was this young, incredible auteur, and everyone really loved him because Lethal Weapon, while not being the first ever buddy cop movie, he kind of borrows a lot from 48 Hours.
Mm-hmm.
It actually did set the standard, though. He perfected everything that was in 48 Hours, and then it became the movie from which all the buddy cop movies just ripped off from.
That's what I think Bahir was talking about. You forget it now because Lethal Weapon is like the standard, and that so many things have taken from it, and it, the series itself has become a parody almost. That watching that first one, it's really raw and gripping and clever and smart. Like rewatching these movies over the last while, I never felt like I was missing something. You have to keep up with them, but it's not like, hang on a minute, why? It's not like you're the third act of a James Bond movie where you're like, how has this got to do with a clown in Brussels?
All of the scripting is so tight in all of his films. And, you know, by the time he was 27 years old, I think he had written 4 of the biggest selling Hollywood screenplays. He was the Max Landis of the 80s, I guess.
Yeah.
That's one line to draw. But as Ian was saying, watching this back, and I hadn't seen this in a long time. This movie came out in 87. Lethal Weapon came out in 87.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels almost like a bad copy of everything else, but then you realize that
this is the original.
You know, so there have been probably better buddy cop relationship films later, but it's just a more polished version of this, I think. You know, so you can still see a lot of the relationship building that this film goes through, and I really like that, and I really like how, yeah, like you were saying, Omar, it's raw. You know, this film is still very raw.
And that's probably why it hasn't dated, right? I saw it a couple of nights ago, and I think the reason it hasn't dated is because, one, of the language used, also of the raw violence in the film that wasn't just violence for the sake of violence.
Mm-hmm.
It felt very fitting that these characters behaved in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the tightness of the script meant that 30 years later, it hasn't dated.
There's a video on YouTube by a commentator called The Nerd Writer. And he talks about Black's use of violence. And there's a beautiful moment in it where he's talking about, he has like the shot of a house outside and Riggs and Murtaugh walking up to it. And he says, you know, Black likes to visit violence on unsuspecting neighborhood. And then the house blows up. And then there's a shot from The Last Boy Scout of a car blowing up. And he does like this a lot where you have, hey, here's a quiet moment in the script. Here's an explosion, but that explosion is not there for no reason, and it will get the story moving back along as it goes. And he does this fantastically. The whole video is about like the use of violence and properly using violence, not just having it there as a crutch to prop up the rest of your Transformers movie. And there's one, the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, there's the moment where Robert Downey Jr., like he's just, the movie is already motoring, and then his finger gets slammed in the door and comes off, and it's completely subverts your expectation. And Black's movies do this all the time. Every time you're watching it, you think, okay, this is where it's going. And then it just slaps you in the face or hits you, you know, hits you with a gun in the face regularly. And you're going in a completely different direction and you're completely on your feet, but you're never lost.
That brings me back to why Shane Black uses Christmas as a setting. And I'm going to quote from him as well. I think this was in an interview from just before The Nice Guys, I think, where he goes, Christmas is fun, it's unifying, and all your characters are involved in this event that stays within the larger story. Its roots, I think, grounds everything. At Christmas, lonely people are lonelier, seeing friends and families go by. People take reckonings. They take stock of where their lives are at Christmas. It provides a backdrop against which different things can play out, but with one unifying global heading. And I've always liked it, especially in thrillers, for some reason, it's a touch of magic. And he's absolutely right about the global setting as well. We can relate immediately to a Christmas movie over here in Malaysia as much as someone can in China or America or Germany, right? It's the same thing. And that provides, I think, a great starting point where you require, yet again, very little exposition to get that story moving.
Yeah, looking at the beginning of Lethal Weapon, there's exposition done, and it's not done in the lazy way that it's done now. I mean, I hate to pick holes in Rogue One from last week, but the conversation between Saw Gerrera and Jyn Erso is literally just, I haven't seen you since you were 16, and you left me alone when I was a really good fighter. It's like, you were the best fighter. You know, it's literally all exposition, but Murtaugh in the bathtub with his kids visiting when he's 50 and just going down, having breakfast and leaving. You learn so much about the character in that scene. You learn that he was a Vietnam vet. All this stuff just comes up.
Even Riggs, alone in his camper van by the sea. I think naked. There's hardly any dialogue spoken. But yeah, him standing naked looking forlorn.
Yeah.
Oh, such a great introduction to Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Right?
Such fabulous hair.
Yeah, that hair. Yeah, that hair itself reminds you that it's a movie from the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of want to bring that back.
That what, hair? The hair?
Yeah.
MacGyver's mullet?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's missing.
Yeah.
Bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bells chime and jingle bell time.
And we're back. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan alongside Bahir Yusuf and Ian McNally on this special At the Movies Christmas episode. We're looking at the films of Shane Black. It's a show we're calling Dreaming of a Black Christmas. Shane Black has written Lethal Weapon, The Monster Squad, The Last Boy Scout, Last Action Hero, Long Kiss Goodnight, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys, which he also directed. He's directed three of those movies, right? Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to recommend for all you loyal listeners a Shane Black movie for your Christmas viewing pleasure and tell you why you really should watch this over your regular screenings. I mean, watch Die Hard, but throw in a Shane Black movie because it's a Black Christmas.
I watched a handful of those over the last couple of days. The one I enjoyed the most was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
That's probably his best film, as in his tightest film.
I think it's sort of, it almost feels like the culmination of what he's done in the past. The storytelling method, the sort of, not buddy cop, but the buddy film. And then it's sort of, I wouldn't say, not in a bad way, but he loosens up after that. So like Iron Man has a little bit of it. Nice Guys tries to sort of recreate a little bit more of what he did there, but didn't quite. I mean, to me, it was, I still prefer Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was probably his most meta film as well. Right?
Yeah, it's set in Hollywood.
It breaks every rule.
Everyone's a vapid actor, and it breaks every rule. Narratively, you have an unreliable narrator. They play with all the cliches of the genre. He also, like, he knows the rules and he knows when to break them.
He also employs a lot of self-criticism in that film of other Shane Black movies, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's a torture sequence.
Yes.
There's he points out all of these tropes and cliches that he used in all of his films.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but is it the torture scene from Lethal Weapon playing on the TV in the house in The Last Boy Scout? Because I was trying to figure out, because it's quite, you can't see it
oh,
quite
I
well.
Oh, I missed that. I need to look
and
that
I think
up.
It, yeah. I thought, because I'd forgotten Mel Gibson was hung up was and tortured hung up, in that yep. movie. And it's a scene of someone being hung up and tortured like that.
With electricity as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what happens in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
yeah. Robert Downey Jr. in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. It's also his career-saving performance, right? That was him coming back after his long bender.
Yes.
With drugs and alcohol and all of that stuff.
Playing a thief-turned-actor who gets caught up in a...
That's right.
Like, he just gets caught up in this mystery. And it ties into detective novels. There's these Johnny Gossamer books in the movie. And it kind of... Like, the plot... There's always two cases in those books, and that ties into the plot of this movie. And I think at one point, it's in The Last Boy Scout and this, I think they talk about there's no more heroes anymore, and also this is not a movie. I think Gay Perry says it to him, like, this is not a movie, yeah. this is not a book, go yeah. home, you're going to get killed.
Yeah, that's right. Gay Perry, of course, is a private detective played by Val Kilmer. Man, Val Kilmer's good.
Probably the last good thing he did, right?
Exactly. I think yeah. it was before he got overweight and started hiding out in his L.A. mansion, I think. But mm-hmm. Gay Perry, who's also gay.
Yes.
When and it's a very hilarious depiction of a Hollywood gay person.
Yeah. Who's also a detective.
Who's also a detective,
yeah.
Right?
Private Eye, actually.
Yeah, there are all these awful, awful gay jokes in the movie, but they play off so well between Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer. One of my favorite lines in the film, which I still use in real life till today, is when they go, if you look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you're going to find? What, a picture of me? No, the definition for an idiot, which is what you are.
Jesus, look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No, the definition of the word idiot, which you f***ing are.
Like, everyone gives Gay Perry hell, but he's even faster than Robert Downey Jr. in that movie.
Oh, he
is. At retorting. And, like, it's one of those things... You get cramp writing all the notes, and also half of what they say we can't say on radio.
No,
so
we can't.
I didn't even write those down in case let one out.
Just watch it. Yeah. Just watch it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I fell in love with Michelle Monaghan in that movie, and it also kind of got me into thinking more about, like, this is the kind of movie I would love to make if I was ever to make a movie, and got me more into thinking about filmmaking and everything else and being on, you know, the radio and reviewing them.
You're right, because that movie actually breaks down the process of narrative better than a lot of other movies I know. I mean, Shane Black is great with the narrative voiceover. And you know how there's that rule, right? Bahir, you know this, in filmmaking where they tell you to avoid the narrative voiceover at all costs.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bullshit rule, because I think if you do it well, then you get a Shane Black movie.
No, the thing is, don't... The problem is when you start with a narrator, it tends to become a crutch. You tend to use it as a tool to move the story along.
Yeah, I mean, don't fall on that.
Yeah, so don't fall on
the Blade Runner issue. People don't understand what's going on. Narrated.
So you throw in a narrator for it. Yeah. Whereas with Shane Black's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the narrator is actually unreliable.
And it's part of the entertainment.
It's part of the entertainment, yeah. So it's almost as if you hear what he says, but then you don't sort of, you take it with a little bit of grain of salt almost, you know, because he will sort of double back, he will jump forward, he will forget something and then go back to that again.
The film reel, like, it's not digital, the film reel stops, like, oh wait, go back, I forgot to explain something earlier that will make this make sense.
I mentioned the robot cop, and I forgot to bring it up again.
It's like, I'm just like my dad telling a bad joke.
Yeah, yeah. So I think if you use it as part of the storytelling, as opposed
crucial to
just
the plot.
Yeah,
And unfolding of the plot, as opposed to, hey, audience, let me help you through this.
Yeah, exactly. Because when you do it that way, you're giving yourself an excuse or a way out to just jump over plot holes, right? Whereas this one doesn't. It's guiding you along, but very unnecessarily. Mm. I mean, if you take it out and you sort of rearrange the films where... You rearrange the clips so it doesn't have to double back and stuff. The film still runs fine.
Yeah.
You know, but I think with the narrator, who is the main character of the film, makes it significantly more entertaining.
when you lose your love. And it makes your life turn cold when it tears you apart. Your heart and soul just can't go on. When love's alive, it sets you free. When it's gone, it's plain to see how even love can become a lethal weapon. When you lose control,
and you're scared. Ian, what about you? I think I have an idea what your favorite Shane Black movie is, if only because in the lead up to this episode, you've not stopped talking about The Last Boy Scout.
It is, having not watched it in years and rewatched it just recently, it is, okay, the tie to Christmas is tenuous at best. Bruce Willis's daughter is drawing pictures of Satan Claus and his wife needs to talk to him about that. But I think The Last Boy Scout, the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and The Nice Guys, they're almost like a Sad Sack Detective Buddy trilogy. Because there's no one more downtrodden than Bruce Willis in this movie. He sleeps in his car. Kids throw dead squirrels at him. You know, he gets up in the morning, goes to the office, and then goes home to his wife to go to sleep. And his best friend is in the closet, having been there the night before with his wife. And it's just like, at some point, I think there's a line in Lethal Weapon as well about, like, you know, God hates me because he's paired me with Riggs. And yeah, he's like, well, I hate him back. Hate him back. It works for me. And Bruce Willis is constantly saying, everybody hates Bruce Willis in The Last Boy Scout. Like, he's just, he's a terrible human being, but he's also a really good detective and he's a good shot. And like he's slowly redeemed, but not really. The world more revolves around him.
It feels like Shane Black got more cynical about Christmas as his movies went along. Because you're right, The Last Boy Scout. And for those of you who don't know, yes, another buddy cop drama, comedy,
one's a detective,
thriller.
One's an American footballer.
That's right. Starring Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, right?
And Halle Berry.
A very young
Halle Berry for a little bit.
And it builds upon that relationship that he has, that he started in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
And kind of progressed along all the way to The Nice Guys. But yeah, it seems like a far more cynical film about the family unit.
Is it though? Because by the end, I mean, it's cynical in a way, but like the wife is like, you're never here. And just for once, I want you to scream and shout at me or something like that. At the end is a very tender moment where he says all the things back to her. Black movies also refer to themselves over and over and over again. They're like ridiculous Chekhov's guns everywhere. You know, they show things and then you use them again later. Yeah. He says all the things she wanted him to say to her earlier, like she said in a fit of rage. And it's a very tender moment and they hug. And it's like he's redeemed his humanity in a way. He's not the bum he was, although no one does stubble better. Everyone has stubble in these movies as well.
No, but isn't that, I mean, it's a tender moment, but it's an incredibly cynical tender moment in his rage.
In a way, I mean, he's on the way back. The other thing about The Last Boy Scout is the Tony Scott direction. It is so 80s. It's amazing.
I miss Tony Scott.
Everything is shot at sunup or sundown. You know, the smoke in every scene. Everyone's sweating all the time. They're so shiny. Like, it's set around football. It's around corruption or gambling in American football. The big Friday Night Lights thing. It opens with someone singing Friday Nights Are Great for Football. Like, it's an ad for TV. Yeah, and while some of the other credits play out, it's just, if you think what you think of Top Gun, you think those iconic imagery, it's that, but every single frame is like, every actor. There's another great, I think Black is very lucky with his casting. I mean, he obviously writes good villains, but The Last Boy Scout is they ice numerous bad guys before they even find out what's going on. Like, guys just turn up, give them grief, and then
they get shot.
And they get shot or get blown up by Semtex. But every single one of them is unique looking, like, and has some trick, or not has some trick, has some trait or characteristic, or has a weird look to them, or has a funny way of talking. Like, they all have something in them. And it's in all the movies, like Mr. Joshua in Lethal Weapon.
And the way he kills his characters, they're always incredibly unique and unexpected as well. There's a fantastic scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang where Robert Downey Jr.'s character wants to threaten a bad guy with Russian roulette.
Mm.
And he spins the barrel of the gun and shoots him on the first shot.
Yeah. What's the chance of that, like 8%?
8%. Yeah. He's like, who taught you math?
Yeah.
I think that you are bluffing right now.
Harry, what are you doing?
Well, what I'm doing for the guy who likes to bluff is I'm playing a little game called Am I Bluffing? Huh? Where is she? Where the f*** is Harmony?
Harry.
You want to play hardball? I can do that. Where is the girl?
What did you just do?
I put in one bullet, didn't I?
You put a live round in that gun.
Oh, yeah. There was like an 8% chance.
8%?
Wasn't it just 8?
8?
Yeah.
Who taught you math?
It's unexpected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it immediately changes the dynamic of that moment, which is supposed to be absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to pound this guy for information, and instead you shoot him in the head.
Yeah. There's a moment in Last Boy Scout where they disarm a bomb that was going to be in Halle Berry's car that Damon Wayans was going to take. And as he's putting the Semtex in his trunk, he's like, you going to put that in your trunk? Because I'm not going to leave it around here for the kids to find.
You're just going to put that in the trunk? No, we should just leave it on the street for the neighborhood kids to play with.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Some bad guys turn up. So he just casually impales the Semtex on a post inside the boot, the trunk of his car. And then they're looking for something, a letter. He says, it's in the trunk. And this, every sentence from these two henchmen, one guy's a smart guy and like he's using Scrabble words like to talk about he's a Scrabble champion. And the other guy just keeps hitting them. Until eventually he says, like, give me the keys. So he takes the keys out of his pocket and throws them away. Gets hit in the face for his trouble. The guy goes and shoots the trunk. So the two heroes dive out of the way. The car explodes. You have your great moment of, they have outwitted the villains. Then the car rolls down the hill after them. There is always these moments of, we've been really smart, but oh my God, we're really dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Last Boy Scout is a good, good film. Before we get into my favorite movie, I think it's important to talk about The Long Kiss Goodnight, which was a box office flop, but I found it to be a great film.
Yeah, I think the problem...
This was Gina Davis doing Jason Bourne before Jason Bourne.
Yeah, yeah, although the book did come out first, I suppose.
That's right, that's right.
And I think it was one of... Black got like a crazy high pay. It was 4 at the time,
million.
Yeah, it was one of the highest paid, which he probably... Like, it really is just like take Bourne and put him in a dress and have him baking cookies.
That's right.
I rewatched that as well. I think the biggest problem with that movie is that it's directed by Rennie Harlan.
Yeah, Cutthroat Island. Yeah. What were you thinking, Rennie?
Because you compare it to, say, you know, Tony Scott or Black himself, there's just... A lot of the wireworks looks like wirework. There's models used at the end. It just doesn't quite sell itself that much. But it does have, and again, it's a different pairing, but Samuel L. Jackson in that movie is fantastic.
He is.
And he's relatively young at that time as well. It's like, you always assume he's been that age, like Morgan Freeman, you know what I mean? But like,
yeah,
he's kind of ripped in that movie, walking around with his top off and singing to himself. He sings to himself, like little beautiful character moments. He sings to himself to remind himself things. Put my gun in my left pocket. Keys in the right.
And I think that's the most important thing about a black film, in that even though he's making... Because the general conception in Hollywood is that an auteur does not do violence, cussing, and action thrillers, right? But... All of Black's movies have some of the best character development and some of the best characters you'll see in cinema. They're really compelling people that you fall in love with almost immediately and you feel really bad for when something bad happens to them.
Mm.
When Robert Downey Jr. loses his finger in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang...
Repeatedly, he loses it twice.
Yeah. He loses it twice. You cringe, but also you feel genuinely bad for him and you've only had him on screen for about an hour at that point.
But you've already been endeared to them by the fact that he's talked the talk about this guy who's about to assault Michelle Monaghan. There's dark themes in these movies. And he's like, you want to step outside or do you want to walk away? Yeah. And the next scene is just him getting his head slammed off the lawn.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's awful at fighting. And,
he stands up and he's just like, I really got to learn how to fight at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this idea, again, the Nerd Writer brought this up in that YouTube video. The violence in his movies are messy and awkward. And, you know, like even someone who knows what they're doing, like Russell Crowe's punch to the nose in Ryan Gosling at the beginning of The Nice Guys, it's like, it knocks him for six. They're not shrugging off punches. I mean, you still have Mel Gibson wrestling with Gary Busey at the end of Lethal Weapon. Those are men at the top of their game. But everyone else, violence is just like, it knocks you back. It takes you out of the modern day and you're like, what's happening here? What's going on here? And which is what happens if you get popped in the nose. Yeah. You have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
And what better way to spend Christmas than with a fair dose of violence.
Yeah, yeah. And Demerol.
Exactly. My favorite Shane Black movie with a Christmas theme is probably Iron Man 3. It's not my favorite Shane Black movie, but I was watching it again yesterday, and it really struck home how much he managed to cram a Marvel superhero film and cross it with A Christmas Carol. And I think that was quite fascinating. Like, here you have Robert Downey Jr.'s character, you have Tony Stark coming off the Avengers. He's at the top of his game, and yet he's suffering from PTSD after the alien invasion of New York. And essentially, he runs into all of these characters that are kind of symbolic of the ghosts of Christmas, past, present, and future. And he has to face all of these things at the same time. Mm. And that seems to be his journey arc. You know, he's dealing with, on the one hand, the price of his arms dealing days.
Mm-hmm. He's dealing with the fallout from when he was not a very nice person. Never mind the arms dealing, but just like trolling people.
That's right. Aldrich Killian is essentially the Ghost of Christmas Future. He's kind of the human version of what Tony is with all of his metal armor, right? He's this superhero with superpowers, not just a dude in a metal suit.
And he can breathe fire.
And he can breathe fire, right? And he has the ghosts of Christmas Present as well. He's dealing with Gwyneth Paltrow's Pepper Potts and how he's got to live his life and protect all the people around him. And he's failing to do that because he's having these awful, awful panic attacks.
And he has a kid who keeps talking to him about things and generating the panic attacks.
And it's got all of those great Shane Black moments as well. The comedy is great. You know, when the kid's pouring his heart out to Tony in his little shed, saying that his father left him, and Tony Stark's like, well, you know, man up. Dad's leave.
Yeah. Or like he's like, take me with you. And it's like, I'm cold. It's like, well, I don't care. And he just drives off.
Yeah.
There's also a brilliant, watching that movie in the cinema the first time, I laughed my head off because it's a great moment of Shane Black trolling the audience that you get the Paramount logo for a start because it's not a Disney movie.
Yep. Mm.
And then you start hearing Eiffel 65's I'm Blue.
I'm Blue.
And you're like, what the hell is this? And then it cuts to, like, I think it's 1999, something like that?
Yeah.
Where it's like a Christmas party in the past in Switzerland. And you're just like, that's perfect.
Yeah.
The whole audience, you just pull the rug out for them before they even knew they were standing on a rug.
Yeah. And yet again, it reinforces how well he does the narrative voiceover in that film, because it serves the movie very well in two ways. One, it brings you into the story immediately. It takes you into the brain of Robert Downey Jr. and his journey, but more so, and I guess this is apparent in Marvel movies, the fact that Shane Black had to direct and write a Marvel movie, it fills stuff in for the audience who's never seen any of the other Marvel movies.
Yeah.
It makes it immediately accessible.
It's not stupid exposition. Kids come up to him asking about New York, and there's a picture of him flying a rocket through a black hole. And they ask, what was it like in the black hole?
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and it feels natural. It never feels forced.
But the Christmas elements are pretty heavy in this movie. This one is not shy about making those Christmas references.
And he leaves L.A. or San Diego area so that he can fly into the Midwest and be
in the snow,
dragging his Iron Man suit, which is just a beautiful image as well.
It's a wonderful image of a broken down Iron Man suit, and he's dragging it through the snow with like this rope tied to his back. It's great. And the movie, I mean, it ends with him going, what the heck, it's Christmas. And he blows up all of his Iron Man suits, and you get this wonderful fireworks display.
Yeah, I remember watching it, and sort of that last fight, sort of, I went through a roller coaster of emotions, right? Because you see this suite of Iron Man suits just pop up, and you go like, yeah!
Well, that's something you've only ever seen in the comic books, because you didn't think they'd ever be able to pull it off in cinema.
Yeah. So to see all those suits and have them fight, you know, on their own almost, right? Like, so there's
it's dangled in front of you, and he's got like,
yeah.
What is this, suit number 5? Maybe, and he just covers up the Mark 42.
So to see all these suits sort of like fight on their own and doing that. So like the, I can't remember the names, but the one that holds up the structure they're on.
Oh yeah, the big silver one.
Yeah.
They're all named. If you look them up, there is Silver Samurai one, all these different types.
So I also love the fact that, you know, he kept jumping through suits, literally through suits.
Yeah.
He put one on and it blows up. And then at the end, he blows them all up. And I'm just like, no.
No, but that direction, I mean, you know, you go back to the biggest criticism of superhero films being that the third acts are remarkably similar. And then when I watch this again, and Shane Black's direction for that action sequence in the last act is brilliant, because there are so many things, like in Doctor Strange and like in Ant-Man, that you've never seen done. I mean, in Doctor Strange, you had time reverse. In Ant-Man, you had people shrink and come back to normal size in these tremendously fast-moving sequences that you've never seen in film.
Yeah, and I think it's also using, I think that's the clever bit of the writing / directing, is that they're using the characters and their own specific abilities to do what essentially is a big boss fight. You know, so it's not just I'm gonna punch you hard, oh you're gonna punch me hard, I'm gonna punch you harder, you know, as opposed to just Batman versus Superman.
Deep breath.
Whereas this one, you know, you're like, he's using the suits literally like stepping stones, you know, like he would jump through one and then, or he, you know, literally throw an Iron Man.
Well,
they
keep getting blown off him as well.
Exactly. So, but you can't do that with anybody else. Like with Thor, you can't figure out a fight sequence that's like that.
And you take the hammer off him.
Yeah, but then it still becomes a I'll punch you harder than you punched me.
And again, it's just the genius of Black in that, like, Iron Man 2 was not well received, not as well received, let's say. And, you know, they're thinking Shane Black's going to do it. What's he going to do? First thing he does is the most Shane Black thing imaginable. Takes Iron Man out of the suit. He's not in the suit for half the movie. He hasn't got any suits to rely upon. Then, just to prove that he can, he's like, well, I'm not just doing this because I can't write superhero movies. I'm going to put all the suits in the end.
Yes.
You know, it's this beautiful... He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows your expectations. He's going to play with them, and he's going to dangle Iron Man suits in front of you.
Correct. And, you know, watching this again, I think it made me reconsider my list of favorite Marvel movies because I forgot... You know, Captain America has the unfortunate... role of bringing all these people together. So it's not really a Captain America film.
Civil
it just
War.
Becomes another Avengers movie. Even Winter Soldier to a certain extent, right? Meanwhile, Iron Man 3, and maybe because you had three movies already, this character was well developed, and plus the charm and personality of Robert Downey Jr., that he can pull off a film where it's just him solo talking to himself for the vast majority of the movie. There are great action set pieces, like the fight in the small town through the diner and bar and all of that stuff. Great, great bits. But for the most part, it's a really self-reflective film, and that's the kind of stuff Shane Black does the best. All of his characters are kind of talking to themselves.
There's the moment where he's about to... his suit has finally... traveled to get to him, his flying suit, and he's kicking guys' asses left, right, and center, and he's about to blow one guy away, and he's just like, whoa, I don't even like these guys. They're kind of weird, and just drops his gun and leaves.
And I was going to say, the other thing that, watching sort of these movies in a row almost, I kind of got the impression that with Shane Black's Iron Man 3, he was less reliant on, it just felt like he was less reliant on computer stuff. It just felt like, for example, the scene that really sticks out at me was when Iron Man jumps out of Air Force One and has to save the 13 guys.
Which is a phenomenal scene. There are 13
they
people.
They shot live.
And it looks fantastic.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah,
right?
There are 13 people, for those of you who haven't seen the film, falling out of an airplane without a parachute. Iron Man can only carry four of them.
Yeah.
And he's... careening down through the sky, and he creates this daisy chain of human beings to distribute
the
weight.
Barrel of monkeys, right?
Yeah,
barrel of monkeys.
As Jarvis sort of calculates the, you know, how far down they are.
Yeah,
and you're right. That was all shot live.
And that was all shot live.
How many in the air?
13, sir.
How many can I carry?
4, sir.
It sort of goes back to the films in the 80s used to do, where stunts were stunts. Mm. They weren't just against the screen. We sort of missed that.
And, of course, the way Shane Black pulls the carpet from under your feet immediately after that scene, his armor gets run over by a bus as he's trying to cross a highway. And then you find out he's not actually in the armor at all. He's controlling it from a boat, right?
Yeah.
Which is a phenomenal, like, double take.
You completely can't. You can knock the wind out.
Yeah, exactly.
It does.
And then... the suit comes back later in the fight.
Yes.
The prodigal son returns.
Yeah,
right?
And then it just falls on the floor.
And then he just sort of, as he's flying in, he's in this superhero, he's in this great hero pose, right? Hands out, you know, outstretched, ready to take it.
Ready to kick ass.
And then the suit flies in, he pops a little sort of structure, and it just falls apart.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just great.
And it's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also that thing where it's that moment in the movie where, as an audience, you're going, oh, yeah, it's going to come down to it, right? We're going to go for fist fight. And then it just falls apart, and you go like, oh, man.
It's always subvert expectations at every moment.
It's great.
It can be a small moment where two people are just talking, and the long kiss goodnight, like, it starts so innocuously, and then a deer comes through the window, and then the deer starts kicking when it's on the window. You know what I mean? It's really visceral and violent.
Yeah.
Or it can be completely disarming an action scene with a quip or a one-liner, a moment of brevity.
Oh, yeah. And it completely plays off itself as well in every possible way. Even in Iron Man 3, towards the last moments in the action scene, there's a great moment where Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark and Don Cheadle's Colonel Rhodes are hiding behind a crate, and they want to check out how many bad guys there rah. And Robert Downey Jr. gets up and then gets back down again. And Don Cheadle's like, how many are there? And he's like, I don't know, too quick.
There is a lot of gunplay in these movies. Watching The Last Boy Scout again, the noise of that, like their hand cannons in that movie, like they are loud. There's no silencers in that movie, as far as I know. And Lethal Weapon has it as well. And, you know, that idea that guns are not the pew-pew that you get in a lot of movies. Yeah. There is, they are machines of violence and death, and they are loud. Yeah. And they will deafen you and they will hurt.
Yeah, like in Lethal Weapon when they go to the gun range, right? And those, like when, it sort of really brings up the fact that Riggs is still toying with the idea that he just sort of wants to kick the bucket, right? His gun...
Well, he's suicidal in the film.
Yeah, but his
very
gun
early
is,
on, he says, I want... He's like, do you want to kill... After he saves the Joker, he's like, do you want to kill yourself? Murtaugh drags him away. He's like, yeah, and I've got the bullet here. And then like, he puts the gun... Murtaugh gives
his mouth.
It gives Riggs a gun. His gun says, do it now.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't put it at the side. Put it in your mouth. He's like, no, I'm going to put it underneath. That's better. Like, and they're shouting and shouting and shouting. And then he pulls the trigger and it's only Murtaugh puts his thumb in the pin.
Put his thumb in the pin.
And stops it. Like, that is...
No. I mean, all of his
That's
films.
Character development immediately. Yeah. This is like within 10 minutes.
You want to kill yourself? Oh, for Christ. Shut up. Yes or no? You want to die? Yes or no?
I got the job done. What the hell do you want?
You didn't answer the question.
Oh, what do you want to hear, man? Do you want to hear that sometimes I think about eating a bullet? Huh? Well, I do. I do. I even got a special one for the occasion with a hollow point. Look, make sure it blows the back of my goddamn head out. Do the job right. Every single day I wake up and I think of a reason not to do it. Every single day. And you know why I don't do it? This is going to make you laugh. You know why I don't do it? The job. Doing the job. Now, that's the reason.
You want to die?
I don't. I'm not afraid of it. I ain't afraid of it.
Here, take my gun. Don't nibble on the barrel. Pull the trigger. Go ahead, pal. Be my guest. Go ahead if you're serious.
You shouldn't tempt me, man.
Put it in your mouth. Bullet might go through your ear and not kill you.
Yeah, under the chin.
Yeah, under the chin.
I'm hungry. I'm gonna go and get something to eat.
All of his films have these seriously dark moments. There's suicide, there's incest, PTSD, all kinds of stuff.
But then they have to go drive somewhere else together, and it's like, wow.
Yeah, how do you? Yeah, that's an awkward situation.
It's an awkward situation, but it's not what you're expecting. You're expecting it to be dragged out, or it'll find out near the end he's found the true spirit of Christmas. But instead, it's like, no, I'm suicidal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really sort of puts a damper on the moment. I totally agree with you.
But that scene also shows that he's an excellent crack shot because he puts a smiley face
in the target. Yeah, yeah.
And also, guns are loud. He makes a comment about, Murtaugh, and like Murtaugh does not hear him because it is loud in there. Like, they actually use it as part of the ongoing story. So smart. It's like, it makes you feel dumb.
It does. And also it makes a lot of other movies feel dumb. And I think that's where the genius of Shane Black is. That, you know, he went into, I don't know whether they were self-imposed exile or Hollywood exile after the failure
of... Spending some of his money.
Yeah.
He's made so much money.
After the failure of Long Kiss Goodnight, he didn't make anything for about 10 years. And then he kind of came back with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in the directorial writing debut again, re-debut if you will, and he kicked ass. Yeah. I mean, it is such a great film.
And nobody's making those movies like that anymore.
No, they aren't. Right? Nice Guys was the last one like it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we said in our review. It was like, it's been such a long time since we've seen a movie like this.
Yeah, but the Gross Point Blanks or, you know, those witty detective-y movies, we don't get them anymore. The superheroes have taken over, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we're happy with that, but it's great to get these movies.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang feels like a 90s movie, feels like a late 80s film, right? Sure, the camera's a lot more in focus, it's sharper, blah blah blah, but the tone, the relationship between the characters, right? even with The Nice Guys, it just feels like a throwback to a point where storytelling was king and not just animations or graphics or, you know, big explosions kind of thing.
And dialogue was king. And that's what really sells these movies.
Yeah.
So, folks, I think you've got a big list of things to do this Christmas. You've got, you know, today's the 23rd. You've got 2 days till Christmas. I think you can catch up on 9 movies.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, that's fine. It's a weekend. You're good.
You've got no work. You've got Monday as well. You can do a little Boxing Day screening too.
Yeah, you can do that.
Tell us what you think about Shane Black. Do you like his movies? Have you seen lots of them? You can tweet us. I'm on @UmarPagan. Ian?
I'm @McNastyPrime.
Bahir?
I'm @BahirY.
And we're wishing you a very Merry Christmas. Have a good one. You've been listening to At The Movies. This is VFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.